When I was a little girl in Northlake, Illinois, a blue-collar suburb of Chicago, the creek that ran through town flooded during or after just about every storm. Addison Creek was a couple blocks from my house, far enough that my yard never got seriously inundated. We'd sometimes find crayfish in our yard, but only once can I recall bullheads stranded in puddles on Whitehall. The creek ran right along Russ's street, and so his yard flooded fairly often. A dam had been constructed to control the flooding, but clearly didn't succeed in its purpose. It did, however, churn up the phosphates in the water flowing over it so much that soap suds billowed up and floated through the air like miniature cumulus clouds, drifting over our yard whenever the wind was southwesterly. My mother told us that the soap suds were proof that the water was clean, but even before I ever heard the word pollution, I was pretty sure she was wrong about that. On balmy summer evenings, the DDT truck would roll down Whitehall. When we heard the truck coming, my sister and I always closed the windows for the evening, but a lot of kids jumped on their bikes to chase it. The winner was the first to get a grip on the grab bar in back. My brother would tell us who won when he came home drenched and smelly. Our windows were always coated on the inside with an oily amber residue from my parents' Pall Mall cigarettes, and the front windows upstairs and down would be coated on the outside with an oily but clear residue from the DDT spraying. One morning after the DDT truck had gone through while we still had our elm trees in the front yard, I found an adult male Baltimore Oriole dead on our lawn. I knew what he was because he looked exactly like the stamp in my little golden bird stamps book that my grandpa had given me. That was the only Oriole I ever saw throughout my childhood. His body was sticky from the DDT. Snow always looked ethereally white while it was falling, but within hours, the snow along streets in our town would have a black crust. I never wondered why as a kid. It was just a fact of life. It wasn't until I was in college, or maybe even later, that I learned that it was from the lead spewing from cars and trucks all running on leaded gas. More and more everyday Americans were getting increasingly worried about air and water quality. We closed our car windows tightly whenever we were approaching Gary, Indiana, but the smell was still overpowering. In 1967, when I was in high school, in a nationally publicized event, several hundred million pounds of alewives washed ashore on Lake Michigan. On at least one day, the smell of the rotting fish even reached Northlake, a full 14 miles from the lake. I knew nothing about fires breaking out now and then on the Cuyahoga River in Ohio, but on June 22, 1969, right after I graduated from high school, a fire erupted on the river that in some places reached five stories high. That made the national news. It was obvious even to the most ignorant among us that we needed to do something. I never heard the word ecology until Russ took a summer workshop in Missoula, Montana, the summer before our senior year in high school, and I didn't have a clue what it meant until college. Fortunately, a lot of people did understand a lot about the subject and about the fundamental importance of clean air and water. During the 1950s and early 60s, working with Rachel Carson as their editor, Chandler Robbins and others at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service were publishing papers about the effects of pesticides and industrial chemicals on wildlife. I don't remember hearing about Rachel Carson until college, but Silent Spring came out in 1962 when I was in sixth grade. In October 1968, when I was a high school senior, Joseph Hickey published his seminal paper about DDT being related to eggshell thinning in the critically endangered peregrine falcon, a bird I'd never heard of. The upswelling of environmental research provided a scientific basis for a community of lawyers and policy wonks to start crafting sound policies and legislation to clean up the mess. But for their ambitious laws to get through Congress, they needed massive public support, which was sparked by the first Earth Day in 1970. And almost miraculously, the whole nation came together in support of some of the most important legislation of my lifetime. People breathed a sigh of relief when Congress passed the Clean Air, Clean Water, and Endangered Species Acts, carefully written to be invincible, all within 3 years of that first Earth Day. Problem solved, or was it? Sadly, there's a part two to this story. I'm Laura Erickson, speaking for the birds.